Explicit content is found in this episode. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome back to the True Crime Fan Club Podcast. I'm your host, Lainey. In mid-November, I traveled to East Texas to visit my husband's grandparents. We were discussing this podcast, and his granny casually mentioned that she knew of two very heinous crimes that happened near their small hometown of Omaha, Texas. Of course, I had to do some digging. And today, I'm sharing one of those cases with you. Okay, on to the show. The city of Dangerfield, Texas, boasts a current population of 2,413. In the 1980s, the population was slightly larger, 3,000 residents, with a large group of them attending the First Baptist Church. Alvin Lee King III was not a regular attendee of this church, but when he found himself facing a trial for allegedly raping and molesting his daughter from the ages of 6 to 18, he was desperate. Alvin was a former high school math teacher at Dangerfield High School. He taught many of the students who attended the church. He approached various members of that congregation, asking for them to be a character witness for him. They all refused to be involved. This slight angered Alvin, so on June 22, 1980, he woke up and ate the breakfast his wife Gretchen made for him. When he was done, she collected his plate and placed it in the sink. He grabbed her arm and shoved her into the dining room chair. He begins tying her arms and legs together with a rope and telephone cord, making it impossible for her to break free. She asks what he's doing, and he tells her, "I love you, and I don't want to hurt you." He walks into their bedroom, changes into a pair of army fatigues, a bulletproof vest, and a helmet. An avid gun collector, he packed his AR-15 rifle, M1 rifle, two pistols, and over 400 rounds of ammunition. Gretchen begged him to stop, but he scribbled a note on a piece of paper that read, "Jeremiah is the King of Kings," and left. He made his way to the First Baptist Church in downtown Dangerfield, parked and exited his vehicle. He walked up the church steps and kicked in the double doors. He then yelled mightily, "This is war." He sprayed the unsuspecting congregation with bullets from his M1 rifle. The shooting was captured and heard by listeners of the KEGG radio station that often broadcasted the Sunday service. He fatally wounded several congregants, including 7-year-old Gina Lynham, who was shot in the head. She was dropped off by her father only minutes before the shooting began. He managed to shoot and wound 13 people before he was tackled to the ground by Chris Hall. Chris managed to strip him of the two rifles he had carried in with him. Two other men, Kenneth Truitt and Red McDaniel, put him in a bear hug and tumbled out the church doors with him. Alvin was able to retrieve a pistol from the band of his fatigues and shot both men. Kenneth died instantly, but Red would later pass away from his wounds at the hospital. He gathered himself quickly and ran to a nearby fire station that was down the street. By now, police in the small town had been alerted and made their way to the grisly scene. Alvin refused to be apprehended and shot himself in the head. However, he only grazed his head and was transported to a hospital in Galveston, Texas. By the time all was said and done, 5 people lost their lives and 10 were seriously injured. He was arraigned and charged with 5 counts of murder and 10 counts of attempted murder. Police surmised that there may be other victims at his isolated farm, but when they arrived, they only found his wife Gretchen, who was scared but unharmed. She informed them that their daughter Cynthia, who was 21 at the time, requested to file charges against her father, accusing him of incest. He denied the claims, but his trial was set to take place on June 21, 1980, a day after the fateful church shootings. He left another note that was later found in the basement of his home that read, "A nuclear first strike by the Russians." They also found a letter from the Soviet embassy that denied his request to become a Soviet citizen. He seemed to believe that the answer to his troubles could be found there. Alvin Lee King III was born on December 23, 1934, and raised in Corpus Christi, Texas, a city that sits on the shores of the Gulf of Mexico. It is ideal, but small. His parents, Alvin Lee King Jr. and Hazel King, were successful entrepreneurs. They owned a liquor store, pawn shop, and an equipment leasing company, making Alvin's childhood very comfortable and strange. Growing up as an only child, his parents owned a lion, cougar, and baboon as pets for the young boy, releasing them to someone else once they became too large to handle. He was a gifted and talented student, graduating with honors from Miller High School in 1953. He attended the University of North Texas in Denton, where he majored in education. When he married Gretchen Gaines, the daughter of a well-known newspaper author, in 1956, he pursued his teaching career, accepting a position at Ray High School in Corpus Christi. He was accepted into medical school at one point, but his aversion to seeing blood kept him from being successful, and thus he withdrew. Later, when he moved with Gretchen and their two children to Dangerfield, Texas in 1966, he accepted a teaching position teaching high school math. He gained a reputation for being a cranky neighbor who would often chastise children playing near his home, telling them to go disturb someone else. When he returned to Corpus to visit his parents in 1966, he was inspecting and cleaning a 12-gauge shotgun that he had bought. His father was sitting directly in front of him when the gun slipped from his hands and discharged around into his head and chest. His father died instantly, but his death was ruled accidental. He returned to his family, a changed man. His time at Dangerfield was marred with oddities. Teachers who agreed to work for the school district were required to sign an oath acknowledging God. He refused to do this for unspecified reasons, but it was an act of defiance that he was allowed to get away with. He was well-liked amongst his students because his teaching methods were unorthodox. When his BNC students wanted to raise their grades, he left it to a game of chance by playing cards with them. When the district announced that they were going to accept special needs students into the classroom, he submitted his resignation. He said he refused to teach, quote, retarded students. He instead decided to become a long-haul truck driver. When he broke his leg the following year, he rented out his truck and eventually sold it. He wanted to live more simply, and he got the opportunity in 1977 when the family home burned down to the ground. Despite being an agnostic, he readily accepted donations from the First Baptist Church, who managed to supply his family with clothes, food, and monetary donations. The $80,000 insurance settlement he received from the damaged home helped him purchase a 100,000-acre farm for his family. They moved to the farm in late 1977, and he began raising peas and cucumbers. He also continued to build a small arsenal for the impending war with Russia. He took up judo so that he could help protect his family. The King family was relatively unseen from 1977 to 1979, until Cynthia King made her fateful trip to the police station to file charges against her father. Gretchen was a well-liked teacher in the Dangerfield School District, but she was often overshadowed in public by Alvin's sense of mental superiority. He also displayed this dominance over his children. He wanted his namesake, Alvin Lee King IV, to become a doctor, but he resented the pressure from his father and often slept through his high school classes. Alvin's temper would flare, and he would go on angry rants storming about the house. Eventually, when Alvin's son graduated, he made his way to Sweden on a student exchange program and then joined the Air Force, leaving his younger sister Cynthia to deal with her father alone. He had no idea of the abuse until his sister called him one fateful day in 1979. He was stationed at an Air Force base in Michigan when he took the unsettling phone call. Cynthia told him that their father had been having unnatural relations with her since she was about 6 years old. Almost instantly, he recounted an event that took place on November 9, 1966. He remembered her coming out from a room, blood streaming down her legs. His father handed him a wooden flute and told him that he was taking his sister to the emergency room and he was to tell them what he did to her. Alvin wanted his 8-year-old son to confess to putting the flute up his sister's vagina. Cynthia had no recollection of the event. When she told her brother she was going to press charges against their father, he agreed to support her and help her in any way he could. In his sworn affidavit, he states, "My father said, if I didn't do as he told, that he would kick the shit out of me." Detectives were able to substantiate his statement by finding an admission record at the emergency room for Cynthia. Alvin was later arrested and his bond was set at $25,000. He posted bail and returned to his farm. He spent most of that year isolated and attempting to find refuge in Cuba or the Soviet Union. He also traded in his gold and silver coins, opened a Swiss bank account, and transfer the property he owned to his mother. I'm going to pause the case right here so you can hear a word from our sponsor. He returned to court after filing a motion to change the venue. The judge approved and moved the trial 57 miles away to Sulphur Springs, Texas. He returned to his farm and began selling off his farm equipment, trying to raise funds for a defense attorney. Gretchen was embarrassed over the accusations and impending trial, but held her head high when she was in town. He worked on his defense and planned to argue in court that his son and daughter were spoiled, entitled, and angry that their father had written them out of his will in the years prior to Cynthia's claim. The trial would have likely ended in some sort of plea bargain, but that's not how Alvin Lee King wanted to go down. Some of his friends attended First Baptist Church, and when they refused to stand up for him, he had had enough. He blamed the church, the institution of Christianity, and the congregants for destroying his life. Due to his self-inflicted gunshot wound, he took 19 months to recover before he could stand trial for his crimes at the church. He had lost a considerable amount of weight, shaved his head, and showed no emotion. When he was hauled back to county jail, he looked directly into the news cameras following his every move and stuck his tongue out. In the news, they called it a message to the city of Dangerfield. He claimed to have no memory of the shooting and could only remember events leading up to his incest trial. His mental state had deteriorated greatly due to the bullet that went through his frontal lobe. He made statements to state psychologists that there were people out to get him and that other prisoners were growing jealous of his ability to read their minds. His condition slowly improved and eventually his trial was set for January 25, 1982. Alvin's son had returned to Dangerfield to help his mother, who was at this point a social pariah. Many blamed her for not being a good mother because if she had, Alvin would have been in the state penitentiary long before the shooting. Several families of the victims sued the King estate, which placed a freeze on Gretchen's ability to sell the farm and move away. She had filed for divorce from Alvin just 13 days after the shooting, but many believe she was a quiet co-planner with her husband. Authorities discovered an extra bulletproof vest and a gun purchased by Gretchen. No charges were ever filed against Gretchen, and she maintained her innocence. Cynthia relocated to Dallas to start a new life and only maintained contact with her brother. Linda Gant, a resident of Dangerfield and a born-again Christian, began corresponding with Alvin a few weeks after the mass murder. She felt that God told her to speak with Alvin and let him know that God loved him. She spent the next year praying and speaking with Alvin, who was resistant at first. Residents of Dangerfield were torn over her conduct, but she eventually moved to Rusk, Texas to be near Alvin. She even brought Hazel King, Alvin's elderly mother, to live with her. When his trial began, she was cross-examined and her intentions were questioned. It was made to seem as if she was intending on having an affair with Alvin if he was ever released. Alvin IV had made amends with his murderous father, who he believed had finally found God. During a change of venue hearing, Alvin was supported in court by Linda, his son, and his mother. He sat emotionless and only shuffled his feet a couple of times. He only showed emotion when he spoke to his mother and told her he loved her. He seemed unaffected by the families who were having to relive their horrendous actions of that fateful day. Larry Lynam, whose daughter Gina was murdered, approached Alvin's son and warned him not to get in the way if there was some finishing off to do. Later, Larry would admit that he brought a knife to the courthouse that day, intending to kill Alvin. Alvin IV took the threat to police, but they did not take him seriously. He and his grandmother visited Alvin in jail on January 18, 1982, to bring him fruit and to talk to him about the events that day. Alvin was shaken from the tape recording of the massacre played for the courtroom earlier that morning, though he never showed it in court. And hearing of his son's confrontation with the victim's father left him with the resolve to help absolve his family of their burden. Alvin IV believes that his last conversation with his father about Larry Lynam's statement is what drove him to the events on January 19, 1982. Guards recalled him pacing in his cell around 10:45 p.m., but he remained quiet the rest of the evening. Around 3:45 a.m., he woke up and stripped his state issue towel into strips. He fashioned the strips into a noose and slipped it around his neck. He bent down on his knees and leaned forward. He lost consciousness quickly and eventually died. The guard on duty was behind in his hourly rounds, which left Alvin with plenty of time to complete his suicide. He was discovered around 5:45 a.m. and pronounced dead at the scene. His family was shocked by the news. The possibility of Alvin completing suicide would have never crossed their minds. Just like that, overnight, his crimes were never prosecuted and his victims never received their due justice. Some residents would say that the good Lord would judge, and they were okay with that. Eventually, the family farm was sold, but the status of social pariah never left the King family. Cindy King expressed guilt over the church shooting in 2012. She felt she was the catalyst that led her father to murder. She claims that she found out her father had molested other children in Dangerfield, and she wanted him to face the music for the crimes he perpetrated against her and others. A documentary called Faith Under Fire was released in 2012 by documentarian Sandra Hicks, and I recommend watching it to see the impact 30 years after the shooting. Cindy King makes an appearance, but her brother, who has opted to remain out of the spotlight, declined to participate. I stopped by the church on my way back to Dallas. I got out of my car, my husband puzzled by my requests, but sometimes you just have to see where events happened. I walked up to the marker that is erected in the yard of the church, and it listed the names of those slain that day. Gina Lynham, 7. Thelma Richardson, 72. Kenneth Truitt, 49. Jean Gandy, 49. And James Red McDaniel, 53. I looked around and tried to imagine the carnage of that day. Blood-soaked bodies being carried out and distraught family members hiding in fear, hoping the loved ones they were separated from had made it through the hail of gunfire. I imagined where they placed the police barricades on either side of the street, and then having to bring out the body of 7-year-old Gina, who lived a short life but likely had a lot to offer. I shook my head in shame. Knowing that it wasn't hard for my brain to imagine these images or to see the scene. After all, mass shootings are all too common in the United States.
It was 30 years ago today when a man armed with several weapons burst into a small Northeast Texas church and started shooting. When it was over, 5 people were dead, 10 others injured. For one man, the massacre took away something precious. For another, it was a call to action. CBS 11's Jay Gormley traveled to Dangerfield to bring us their stories.
Larry Lynham is a part of history, a part he'd rather forget.
Back in 1980, it wasn't called terrorism. It was just evil.
30 years ago, evil came in the form of a teacher turned crazed killer in a small Texas town.
This literally grabbed a nation.
350 people were packed into First Baptist Church of Dangerfield for Sunday services. Alvin Lee King III came packed with an AR-15, a hunting rifle, and some handguns. Witnesses say King burst into the church and yelled, "This is war." He then opened fire, killing Larry's 7-year-old girl.
And Gina was a little girl so full of life, so beautiful.
On that tragic day, Larry was not inside with his daughter when she was killed. Even though he's Baptist, he was across the street at the Methodist church filling in as music director. And that's when he got word that his daughter had been shot.
My wife comes in and says, "Larry, come quick. Gina's been shot." And I'm thinking, Gina's in church. People don't get shot in church.
What haunts Larry to this very day is that his daughter asked if she could sing with him at the Methodist church. But Larry told Gina to stay with her mother at First Baptist.
I've said this to thousands of fathers across our country. When your children come up and want to go somewhere with you, think real hard before you say no.
When it was over, 5 people were dead and 10 others were injured. No one knows what set off Alvin King. We do know he was about to go on trial for the rape of his daughter. But 18 months after the shootings, King hanged himself in jail.
There's a lot of things that we have not done that have left the door open for evil to creep in.
Jimmy Meeks was married in the church 3 years before the tragedy. He wasn't there for the massacre, but his wife's grandparents were. Meeks is a detective for the Hearst Police Department and is now using the unthinkable to get churches to think.
And the more I looked at the stats, the more I was just somewhat stunned by it and said, we need to do something about churches, helping them to get prepared in case a shooter comes in.
Detective Meeks travels the country teaching church security. He helps congregations assemble volunteers to be the eyes and ears during worship.
And that is helping churches get beyond the mentality that we're safe in the house of God. It is not a safe house in the mind of a criminal.
Two men, two paths. One teaches that a safe house is not always a safe place. The other shows us that sometimes time doesn't always heal all wounds.
I know our psychiatrists and our psychologists and our counselors of today are always saying we need to bring about closure. I don't have any of that. And quite honestly, I don't know what that is.
Okay, fan club members, as I conclude this episode, my one question to you is, how will you sleep tonight? Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to leave us a positive review on Apple Podcasts or your podcast player of choice. It really does help us out. You can find us on most social media platforms, Twitter at TCFCpod, Facebook.com/TCFCpodcast, Instagram, TCFC_podcast, and of course, our website is truecrimefanclub.com. Music for the show is provided by Nico at We Talk of Dreams. Check him out on Twitter at We Talk of Dreams or WeTalkOfDreams.com. This episode was written, researched, and produced by me, Lainey.